This episode of The Ish is sponsored in part by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/The Ish. Again, visit audibletrial.com/The Ish for your free audiobook. Life is complicated. It's layered. Religion, love, politics, there are no easy answers. If you, like me, are drawn to the middle, whether by chance or by choice, this is for you. From Milieu Media Group, welcome to The Ish, a podcast from the liminal spaces of life. I'm Cameron Deason-Hammond, and this is episode 10, Famous-ish, with my brother, Alex Deason. Welcome to this episode. I am sitting here with my brother, Alex Deason, whom I met at his birth and have known ever since. Alex is best known for his work with the Brooklyn band The Damwells, who got their start in 2003 with a release on Epic Records. And he has been making music ever since. So welcome, Alex.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming to my show.
Thanks for being my sister and letting me on your show.
So I wanted to start with 2003, The Damwells, Epic Records. What was it like to start a career in the music business when the music business was imploding?
I think that we always thought of being on a record label as a necessity that was not necessarily a reward, because we started playing shows long before we made recordings. Mm-hmm. So we started playing shows in 2000, and then we started making recordings in 2001, and then we settled into making a full-length record in 2003. So when we signed with Epic Records, I feel like it was a little bit more the pressure of the people around the band, management, lawyers, things like that. Not that it was bad. It's just that was the end goal,
right,
with the people that we had around us that were employed, in essence, to be our management or advisory council type people. So when we signed to a record label, it was really just out of necessity to keep that going. Mm-hmm. And also because, you know, there's something about the carrot and stick that eventually you do get the carrot in some cases. And I think that it felt like this was actually a real possibility that we could be on a record label and have a career, mm-hmm. a major record label, that is. And we were told this over and over again, that this was a development deal, that they were going to let us make our first record and hope that we sold a certain number of copies and we're not aiming for the moon. Mm-hmm. And then we went and made that record, which was actually in 2005, 2006, which was after the first record, after we'd already released our first record on Epic. We started making Air Stereo, and under the idea that we were making kind of a free-spirited rock and roll record. And then we quickly found out that that was not the case, that we were actually, you know, on the chopping block and we needed to have a hit. And, mm-hmm. and that kind of came after the fact. So I guess to answer your question, it was confusing, mm-hmm. to be on a major record label at that time, because there was still this air about being an American rock and roll band was cool. It was a viable commodity, mm-hmm. and it was something that could potentially outlast the record label, and so they were invested in creating a platform for your career. And then as the record label imploded, which was, you could sort of see it coming, but then when it happened very suddenly around 2000, when you're talking about 2003, and then was a sort of projected collapse in 2006, we felt all of a sudden that we were very much on the chopping block. The record label had us go re-record 3 songs with a different producer, rearrange some songs, and it was not fun, you know.
Yeah. I think of those years as sort of like a bit of a, you know, a break in the tectonic plates in the way that we consumed music, right? So, you know, you're describing the first part, you know, the early aughts when you could still get a deal and it was a development deal, the idea to develop an artist and to let an artist explore and grow, right? And then all of a sudden, a couple of years later, it's like, no, you have to have a top 40 hit. You have to sound like Maroon 5 or whoever the hell it was at the time, right? And that's not, you know, not everyone has that experience. That's a very specific, like, historical positioning that, you know, your career unfolded, you know, across that time span. And I think it's interesting what you say about necessity, because it's like, you know, back then, in order to get your music heard by people, you had to have a record label. Mm-hmm. People were not, you know, indie music was actually indie then. Yeah. It was very small. It was very expensive. It was very hard to do. And so what the label provided was all of the infrastructure to get you in the hands of, your music in the hands of, you know, people who would love it and buy it and, you know, go to shows. And the whole model since then has changed. You know, even the way we listen to music, right? Digital versus analog. And so I kind of wonder, like, if you could talk about how you've navigated that shift from Epic to now you're an independent, you're truly an independent artist, right? In mm-hmm. some ways, maybe not. But how the model used to be like streams of income set up through a big corporation, and then you're on your own, right? As an artist to figure it out for yourself. So, like, what does that look like for you, and how do you navigate that, and how does it affect what you write? You know, if you don't have a guy telling you it needs to be a top 40 hit, does that influence what you write and how you produce? And
well, the time during which someone told me I had a top 40 hit was very short-lived, so I haven't had to like try to do that. I mean, I guess I don't really know how to answer that in one fell swoop, but I can take many swoops.
Take all the swoops you want.
I mean, the way that I have survived has always been through patronage, small labels, or, you know, GoFundMe, Pledge Music type things to make records. The Damwells have made a bunch of records with fan funding. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's how it's survived that long. And then the technology caught up, and now I can make records in my apartment without putting on my pants. So I don't, you know what I mean? I don't have to really do much to make what is, in my opinion, a quality recording. So I think that the way I've survived is, I think the way that anybody survived that time is just by adapting.
I mean, so you were always, I mean, I can say this because I was there.
That's right.
You were always recording yourself. Like, I remember you in the living room with like two tape decks, like splicing, like literally cassette tapes together somehow. Mm-hmm. And creating like
well,
sort
I wasn't
of a,
splicing them, but
what were you doing? I don't know what you were doing.
I was taking a boombox and using headphones, like, if, you know, just conventional headphones that you put on your, not earplugs or whatever. One of them can be used as a microphone if you plug it into the microphone channel. And so I was plugging that into something like a boombox and pressing record. Mm-hmm. And then I was, this is what I was doing. So it has a double cassette tape deck. So as I was dubbing one tape to the other, you could also record a line.
Right.
So I was adding one track at a time and then swapping the cassette tapes and then recording one more track and then swapping the cassette tapes again and adding track after track. Okay. The problem with that was once you got to track like 18, tracks 1 through 4 were basically inaudible.
Right. But I mean, you were figuring out how to do multi-track recording, like, again, in your underwear.
Yeah.
I think you were like 11 or 12, maybe? Yeah. 13?
The tidy-whitey years.
I mean... But so it's like that side of it has always interested you, it would seem.
Yes, it has.
So are you still doing that? Are you producing? Yeah. Are you?
Yes. A lot of the way that I make my income is by producing records for other people. So I produced a record earlier this year for this band called The Nadas from Iowa, who were like a regional rock and roll band. And then I recorded
We know The Nadas.
And then I recorded another record late last year by a Houston band called Lawndale. And I recorded a record by a guy named Joshua Fletcher a couple years before that. And I like recording records for other people because it allows me to continue to do that thing, which is to play and to discover. And that's, I think that's ultimately why I still like making records, because when I'm making a recording of my own music, I'm discovering new ways to do things. We were just listening to something on the way over, and there's like a vocal in one of the songs of mine where the last line is like in an echo, but the rest of the line isn't. And I remember when I figured out how to do that, and I was like, oh, that's something I can do, and I know how to do that now. It's like in my toolbox. And I think that was exciting to do that. So that kind of drives the engine, as well as, you know, wanting to make art or wanting to make songs.
So where does that come from?
The drive?
The wanting to make art or wanting to make songs, you think?
I have no idea.
Where did it start? Can you trace it back to a...
I guess it probably started when I was like doodling. Mm-hmm. You know, drawing pictures and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then that was boring. So I wanted to like make the drawings like do stuff. So I would like do these little battles on a piece of paper where there would be one army on this one side. Yeah. And then I would like draw lines of like, oh, they're shooting at these guys. I guess that was probably it.
Like the impulse to make stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. And I mean, I know the family lore, you know, I know how the lore goes, which is that, like, I had a vocal teacher who had me in a recital, and you came to the recital and pronounced that you could do it better than everyone that had performed in the recital.
I don't remember that.
And then proceeded to do so and was, well, a lot of people don't know that you, you know, as a child became a child actor. You got a manager, you auditioned. The first audition you ever went on in New York was for the first national company of Les Miserables. You were all of 9 years old and you were cast in Les Mis.
All true.
All true. Do you remember that experience?
Yeah, of course.
What do you think of that now, or how did that affect you as a as the artist you are today? Did it or did it?
I think that it, I always feel like interviews should be done with people after they're dead.
Then they can be like, how do you do that?
Because they can look back and be like, oh, now I realize the significance of that. I think that it just kind of introduced me to performance at an early age. And so I wasn't afraid to get up in front of people and perform.
Yeah.
In fact, I was so, it was my job when I was 9 through whenever 11 or 12 that I was like kind of bored with it, you know? That I could get up on stage and perform and not even really, like, partition my brain, half of it be in another world and the other half sort of on autopilot, which I did do many times when the dam was, and which I still do to this day by myself sometimes, you know? So I think that it just cut to the core of what it is to give a performance and to do so without any, like, reservation.
Of, self-consciousness.
Yeah, or- without being, or at least to be aware of the self-consciousness and to use that in some way to your advantage, meaning to try to be as human as possible without, you know, without jumping out of your skin and, like, murdering everybody, which is often the way that you feel when you're on stage and people are looking at you and you feel uncomfortable. I don't really have that experience, I think, because early on I was introduced to performance and figured out a way to overcome that in the moment. And kind of make a joke of it, or...
So it's almost like you got started before you were almost old enough to know to be self-conscious, in a way. I mean, you know, I feel this way about watching you perform still. Like, you performed last night at a house show, and I felt this way. But I felt this way when I saw you perform in Les Mis. And, you know, it's an overwhelming feeling for me to see you perform, because I know all the stories. I know, you know, all the background. And I know, you know, as an actor, for example, like, what could motivate a scene that you perform in which your father dies, you know, on the battlefield or whatever. And I remember kind of, like, talking to you about it or broaching that with you. And, like, you weren't in that same place. Like, what you were projecting wasn't necessarily what you were feeling, which is interesting also.
Talking about back in the day?
Back in the day, but also, you know, today, like you said, like, you can play these songs on autopilot, right? You've sung them a million times. So, for example, like the song 55 Pictures you played last night.
Right.
You know, I can't hear that song without losing it. I mean, I'm, like, choking back sobs.
Right.
You know?
Because it's about our father.
Because it's about our father, but it's also about me. My name is in it.
Right, yes.
You know? And the first time I heard that song was live. You were performing it live.
And I didn't give you any warning.
And you didn't give me any warning.
You know what's really sad is that I just didn't even think about it at the time. Because I think I'd performed the song a bunch of times before that, both solo and with the band, that in the middle of performing it, I looked down and saw you, and I was like, oh, I don't think she's heard this before. So, sorry.
Apology accepted. But, you know, it's like with any artist, right? You're making work out of your life, and for someone intimately woven into your life, it's a different experience to see and hear and consume that work, right? Because, you know, you and I, like, may not sit down and have a heavy, intense conversation about our father or some other thing that you've written about, but I can hear through your work, like, at one point, you were having a heavy, intense conversation with yourself about it, you know? And so I get a glimpse into, like, what you're thinking and feeling through, you know, we started out, you as a kid, through your performance on Broadway, and here we are today, you know, you performing in recordings and, you know, in live performances and stuff. And it's an interesting thing. Like, it's not like everyone watches their sibling share their family's stories with, you know, the world. And I obviously do the same thing because...
So what's that like, Cameron?
Well, you know, speaking of stories, I mean, that kind of takes me to something else I wanted to talk to you about. You spent time in and received a, you know, earned an MFA from the University of Iowa. So that's another thing that you do. You write prose and you tell stories that way. So I wonder if you could talk about that. What inspired you to take that turn? You know, were you always writing prose? I mean, I know, I remember you writing stories. I remember you writing fiction, like, as a young kid. Mm-hmm. But when you went to Iowa, it was kind of in the middle of the Damwells, like, doing a lot of stuff in my memory. Mm. And it was, yeah, like, kind of a, like, you know, like, I'm going to go do this other thing.
Right.
So, like, what was that? What was going on, you know, for you back then? Like, what was the inspiration to do that?
Again, this is such a great question. You should ask me when I'm dead. And then I'll understand the significance better. I mean, I think that I wanted to, number one, legitimize myself.
Can you unpack that?
Well, I felt that, like, being a songwriter, singer in a band, touring the country, was not a legitimate identity.
Wow.
That I was, like, not a real person, you know, or that I was not a real artist or something.
Okay.
And I still don't even know if that's true. So I thought that I should legitimize my work by putting a stamp on it. Mm-hmm. From a institution of higher learning. And also, I was legitimately interested in reading and writing and learning about stuff. You know, there are many, many hours between major American cities, and there was no iPhones at the time, so we were reading in the van. I know, I wish I could say we were, like, doing lines of cocaine and, like, you know, tattooing ourselves in the back of the van.
You were
but
not.
We were not.
We were reading books.
We were all being very literary and reading books and talking about politics and literature and stuff. So that was always interesting to me, and I felt like my career as a performer and a band member was not where I wanted it to be. So in an effort to legitimize my career or my art, and also to give myself another stream by which to extricate myself from the failure of myself as a musician, which is what I felt at the time, that I would go to get a master's or a PhD or something like that. And there's a lot about getting a master's, PhD, MFA degree that's very attractive to artists in sort of like the circling of the drain, you know, because it can lift you out of that place. Mm-hmm. And it does lend legitimacy to what you do.
Sure.
Because now people could scrutinize my words in a academic way, which I think every songwriter wants that to happen. Mm-hmm. They want to be taken seriously and ultimately very seriously, which can also be detrimental because you don't really need people looking at your words that closely sometimes. Because a lot of times the words, because they are in service of the music as a songwriter, are not the most, you know, florid or mm-hmm. or even economic
right.
words. They're kind of like filler, a lot of usage of the word just, a lot of usage of the word and, but. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think that it gave me the opportunity to say, I'm a real person who makes real art and is dedicated to it as a lifelong commitment. But of course, that didn't work. I mean, I really enjoyed being there and being out of my career as a songwriter / band guy because I could concentrate on something else. And mm-hmm. I put a lot of energy into the time that I was there, especially the teaching side of it, because I was a TA as well.
Right.
And the teaching side of it, I thought was really illuminating. And that was kind of my favorite part, more so than taking classes or even writing. I enjoyed writing because I enjoyed the discipline of something.
Yeah.
Like, I like cooking. I don't even know if I like eating. You know, I just like the discipline of, like, putting things together in a way that gives a result that other people can identify as being good immediately, mm-hmm. you know. And so I liked writing, and I liked putting words together. But I also liked teaching. And I thought the teaching part of it was, like, another kind of performance where instead of getting up there and performing songs about me, I was actually able to help in the performance of, like, a collection of people who were all very young and very new to the university experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that for them to experience education in a way that was not conscripted and being at the helm of that was really cool. Because at the beginning of the semester, they're like, why am I here? I don't want to be in the stupid class. Like, I want to go drink beer and watch football and meet girls and join a fraternity. And by the end of the semester, they had ownership of their existence in a university setting and as a person receiving an education. And I thought that was awesome. And some of those people I still, you know, keep in touch with infrequently, but I'll get notes from them and stuff. And I feel like what we were doing together had an impact
yeah.
that was way more lasting than, you know, a night at a club.
So, like, the difference between teaching a class and performing a song, you know, it sounds like teaching a class is almost like a collaborative creative experience,
right.
whereas, you know, singing a song in a club is kind of more of a one-way, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I've seen you do with crowds what I would imagine you do in a classroom, which is have dialogue and have banter back and forth with the audience. And, you know, and so did your stage presence come about or shift or change after you became a teacher? Did that influence like how you would, you know, sort of like perform a show?
I hate banter with the audience. I hate having to have
You're good at it.
Well, I think I've been like really bad at it at times too, because I hate it being scripted. And when I see other people performing over and over again and it's scripted every night, it is loathsome to me. It's like, I cannot.
Like when you hear
it.
People say the same thing over and over. Yeah, every night.
Yeah. So I hate doing that. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to answer that other than I think they're completely different. The collaborative experience of performing a show is more about the people on stage you're collaborating with. And
that's
really special and important to me.
Right.
Being able to like anticipate what the drummer is going to do at this moment, or the bass player, or bringing the bass player and the drummer together in a moment where you're all like sort of emphasizing something that is not apparent in the song, like emphasizing the upbeat at this part, or, you know, that's really special. And I had a lot of those moments with the Damwells, which I will always cherish, you know, especially with Ted, who I've known for since I was 18 years old. And, you know, and Dave and Steve as well. Just being able to, like, turn to the drummer and, like, really getting into it. And then the drummer's feeding off of that. And that collaboration is incredible. So I think that in that way, they're similar. I mean, the audience, I know this is not going to win me any friends, but the audience is, again, is a necessary evil. Most of them don't care. Most of them are there to either get drunk or pick up the person of the opposite sex. Few of them are paying attention. And then afterwards will tell you how much they loved it, and then they don't really recall any of it because they were either on their phone or not paying attention. And I'm talking about shows where, like, they're there to see me, you know? It's very rare that you get rapt attention, which I think everybody really wants, but then sometimes you don't want it. I mean, the whole thing is so mercurial. It's like you have rapt attention, and you're like, what's wrong with you people? Like, you know, you're alive out there, you know? So I don't know. I mean, I have a weird love-hate relationship with audiences. I often wish they weren't there.
So what are you really interested in now? Like right now, today, like what are you reading? What are you listening to? What are you watching? Like what is kind of getting you excited about any of those three mediums?
I mean, I'm working on a project with my partner, Amber, a band called Broken Baby. And I think that's super exciting. I'm not the singer.
Cool.
So that's takes a load off my back.
Takes a lot of pressure off.
Yeah, that's I think that's exciting, and people respond to it very quickly. You know, like they either really like it immediately or they just don't get it, which is fun, I think. Whereas with like a quote-unquote singer-songwriter, you almost have to say, well, I guess I should just listen to it again. I don't know. I didn't grab me at first. Like as if that somehow inherently has a higher quality to it. Like it's a wine instead of a beer, you know. But I like Broken Baby in that it is like very immediate, and it's also very in your face and unapologetic. That's exciting to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm putting out a record early next year, the third solo record. And I kind of have run out of steam as far as like whether that's exciting to me or not. I mean, I still, when I have to listen to it for like to approve like a test pressing or whatever, I still think it's really good. I just don't care. And I think I don't care because my audience has moved on from me. And I think they've moved on to like their own lives. They've you know, it's funny because I was talking to this about someone else last night. There, when you go from being a guy in a band, you're the same age as the people that like you, mostly.
Right.
And then those people grow up and they have children and they get real jobs. And so their concerns turn internally to their lives. And that kind of moves you as the artist out of their lives or thrusts you even further into their lives where they're like, it's part of the soundtrack of their house and their family and their kids. And that's really cool. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, most of them have to jump off the ship. And then they get to like age 40, which is, I'm almost 40, where their kids are old enough that they can go back to the shows. And so they're rediscovering a lot of those artists. So I think for me, it's, I have to just kind of in some way keep going so that they will age back in to what I'm doing. But I have no horse in the race of the attention of millennials or anybody who's in their 20s. And I have no interest in trying to, not because I dislike them, but I just don't even know where to begin. All of that music to me, even the music that's considered not pop, independent indie music to me just sounds like, it sounds like it's poorly executed, rehashed, unapologetically so, meaning more like without really taking the care to hear something and make something new out of it. you know, which are the bands that I loved and that you loved, like REM when we were growing up.
I've noticed that too, and I think it has a lot to do with it. Like, it's almost like culture has like no attention span, yeah, or no memory, right? Like, and I've noticed this a lot as far as difference in generations, you know. So we are of the generation known as X, and there was so much pressure on originality. Like, originality was a virtue.
Yeah.
And it was like, even though we were too young to know that really nothing is original, but even yet we believed that you should never just mimic to be popular, right? Like, popularity was never. And it was like, if you got popular, it was an accident and you should pretend like you don't care about it or you're not seeking it out. I don't think enough is really said about that, about how different it is today, whereas popularity in and of itself is a virtue.
Well, I think that, like, a lot of that, I think, comes from no one has to move their body to engage with art anymore. And because you don't have to move your body and you don't have to engage your other faculties, mm-hmm, the passion for it is much more ephemeral. So whereas to experience a band, you had to go to the club and stand in the room and feel the heat and the pressure and the sweat and the vibrations of other human beings while you were experiencing this performance, or even standing in front of a work of art and feeling the other people's awe of what you were viewing. Because that doesn't exist in the way that it did when we were younger, because that has been now transferred to social media, the capacity for passion has been watered down so much so that no one cares about who you are. They just heard 30 seconds of your song and they thought it was cool, or they didn't.
Right.
Well,
there's literally no cost to it, right? With streaming, especially with streaming, like, you can listen to an entire catalog and pay .0000001 cent per stream. I mean, it's insane. There's no cost to you.
I didn't realize how important, when it moved to digital download and streaming, I thought, hey, this takes the power out of the hands of the record labels and puts them back into the artists, and we now control our own destiny, and now we don't have to go through the rigmarole of, you know, signed to a record label and pressing up a bunch of CDs and carrying them around. Now it's just available, and I felt like that was giving power back to the artist.
Yeah.
And also because it cut the cost way down or made it, like, virtually nothing. So now there was no, like, financial barrier between the art and the consumer of that art. But actually, all that it's done is put a barrier up that prevents the consumer from really caring about it. Like, they can consume it.
Right.
But because there's no financial tag, and I think that's just because, unfortunately, human beings in a late-stage capitalist society have no real understanding of value unless there's a monetary tag on it. But because there is no monetary value to it beyond what you're talking about, a penny per player or even less, that they don't have the capacity to engage in a lasting way, that is what gave rise to the Bob Dylans and the Tom Petty's of the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know if we'll ever see that again, unfortunately.
Yeah. Alex, thank you so much for being here and letting me interview you.
Thank you.
I enjoyed getting to ask you some questions. And thank you for listening. If you want to follow Alex on social media, you can find him at Alex Deason across all of the platforms, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Spotify. So this is our last episode of the season, and we are hard at work putting together season two and really excited about the guests we have lined up. One thing I really want to include in next season's episodes are your letters about the ish in your life. I have gotten some great letters about struggling with ambition and identity and education. I'd love to hear from you. What part of your identity is the hardest to reconcile? And what I hear from you will definitely help us to shape the episodes that we record for next season. So thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon. This episode of The Ish was produced and edited by Luke Brunner. Our artwork was designed by Heather Hale. To see more of her work, visit halehouse.co. Our theme music is from my 2016 album, Words Don't Bleed, produced by Jay Snyder. Check it out on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review The Ish on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And follow us online at The Ish on Twitter and at The Ish Podcast on Facebook and Instagram.